If it lights up, then you can come to my rescue.
No.
Yes.
A smile lifted the corner of Isolde's lips as she towed out her threadstone and gripped it tight.
You know this plan could work, and it's the only worthwhile strategy I can think of. Let's just be glad that Lejna is a ghost town. There's no one around to get hurt. Except for us, you mean. Stop arguing and start undressing.
Isolde slid from the saddle and looped her reins over a low branch. Then she began unbuttoning her blouse.
A storm's coming, Saf, and you're at its eye. I can be the right hand and you can be the left.
The left hand trusts the right, Matthew always said. The left hand never looks back until after the purse is grabbed.
Isolde had always been the left hand. She'd always trusted Safi to distract until the end, which meant it was Safi's turn to do the same. Charged air burst through the forest. It lashed into Safi, around her, and then gathered itself behind her. She flung a glance back, eyes watering. Storm clouds, dark as pitch, swirled above the treetops.
I don't like this, Safi said,
really having to yell now.
In fact, I hate this. The storm and the plan. Why does it have to be we? Why not just me? Because just me isn't who we are,
Isolde hollered back.
I'll always follow you, Safi, and you'll always follow me. Thread sisters to the end.
A fierce, burning need rose in Safi's lungs at those words. She wanted to tell Isolde everything she felt. Her gratitude, her love, her terror, her faith. But she didn't. Instead, she smiled grimly.
Thread sisters to the end!
Then she did as Isolde had ordered. She clambered from her mare and began peeling off her clothes. Edwin smelled his old mentor a mile away. Her scent, crisp spring water and salt-lined cliffs, was unmistakable. As familiar to Edwin as his pulse. And as unavoidable as death unless Edwin was willing to leave the path, which he wasn't. Or slay her where she stood, which he also wasn't. The mile leading to her passed in a smear of green forest and yellow stone, pre-dawn light and a rumbling sea storm. When he reached the narrowest point in the path, a place bordered by overhanging rocks to one side and wave-pounded cliffs on the other, Edwin relinquished control of his blood. He gave the power of pulse and muscle back to his body and slowed to a stop. Monk Evrain stood still as a statue before him. The only movement was the hot wind in her hair, through her Carowin cloak. Her baldric lacked all of her blades save two. Her sword was nowhere to be seen. The older monk had not changed in the 2 years since Edwin had left the monastery. A bit browner in the face, perhaps. And tired. She looked as if she hadn't slept in days. Weeks, even. Yet her hair was as silver as it had always been. And her expression as gentle and concerned as Edwin remembered. It angered him. She'd never had a right to care about him. And she most certainly didn't have that right now.
It has been too long, she said in that throaty voice of hers.
You have grown. Edwin felt his jaw clench, felt his eyes twitch. Stand aside.
You know I cannot do that, Edwin.
He unsheathed his sword. It was a bare whisper over the crash of waves below.
I will cut you down.
Not easily. Evrain flicked up her wrist. A vicious blade dropped into her hand. With a smooth dip of her back foot, she sank into a defensive stance.
You have forgotten who trained you.
And you have forgotten my witchery, Monk Evrain.
He eased his parrying knife from his hip and matched Evrain's knee-bent stance.
She moved, a spin that sent her white cloak flying. Distracting, certainly, but Edwin had his eyes on her hand. After all, she was the one who'd taught him that the key to any knife fight was controlling the knife hand. Evrain whirled in close. He ducked low to meet her. But it was not her blade that he met. It was her feet, a boot heel in his neck, then the dagger at his chest. He tottered back, not as fast as he should have, as he could have if he were fighting anyone but her. With a burst of magic, he shot back 10 steps, too fast and too far for her to easily catch. Then he glanced down. Her knife had cut him. 4 shallow slices that his witchery would heal whether he wanted it to or not. He would waste power on harmless surface wounds. "You know who they are," Evrain called. She stalked steadily toward Edwin. "It is your sworn duty to protect them." Edwin watched her from the tops of his eyes. "Have you heard the rumors, then? I can promise you, Monk Evrain, they are not the Kar Awen. They're both ether witches." "It doesn't matter." She smiled, a terrifying smile of rapture and heady violence combined. "We must have misinterpreted the records, and no void witch is needed. For I saw it, Edwin. Those girls woke the Nubrevnan origin well." Edwin attacked then, sword out. Yet for some reason he did not lunge as hard as he should have. He did not veer his course at the last second, or toss out knives in quick succession. He simply thrust out his sword, and as he expected, Evrain swirled left and parried easily. "The girls swam to the spring's center," Evrain said. "Impossible," Edwin spun left. "I saw them do it. I saw the magic ignite and the earth tremble." She jabbed at Edwin with her knives, and then snap kicked her toe into his knee. A toe that had a blade upon it. Pain exploded in Edwin's leg, as did blood. He bit back a roar and twirled aside before more blades could reach him. She was trying to wear him down. Small wounds to slow him. But she was breathing heavily now. Something that would never have happened 2 years ago. She was tired. And she would never outlast Edwin. Even with her quick, relentless attacks. Even with him going easy. "What you saw," Edwin said, skipping back, "was what you wanted to see. The well would never let them reach its center." "Yet it did." Evrain paused, hands and blades at the ready, and an exultant gaze fastened on Edwin. "Those girls touched the spring's source and it awoke. Then the waters healed Isult." Isult. The Nomatsi girl with no blood scent. She was not one of the holy Kar Awen. Edwin refused to believe that. She was too plain. Too dark. As for the Truth Witch, if she were indeed the other half of the Kar Awen, then giving her to his father would mean breaking his Carowin vow. The mere thought of that ignited ire in Edwin's veins. He would not lose all his fortunes because Monk Evrain was a gullible, desperate old fool. So in a burst of speed, Edwin let a throwing knife fly. Evrain swatted it from the air and used the momentum of her spin to loose a knife of her own. Edwin jerked left, caught the knife, volleyed it back. But Evrain was already dancing up the overhang, using the terrain to her advantage. She scrabbled easily up the stones, unsheathing her stiletto, her final weapon, and then sprang out at Edwin. He dove forward, rolling beneath her. Then he was on his feet, sword slashing out. It clashed against Evrain's stiletto, locking in place on a parrying prong. Her arm trembled. Her small blade would never stand up to a sword. Her strength would never stand up to Edwin's. "Remember who you are," she ground out. The steel of Edwin's sword slid ever closer to her. At any moment, her elbow would give. Edwin's blade would slice through her neck.
The Kaer Awen have come to save us, Edwin. Remember your duty to them.
Her stiletto slipped. Edwin's blade arced down, bit into her neck. But he stopped it. Halted the blade at the last fraction of a second. Blood pooled on the steel. Evrain gasped for air, eyes huge.
We are done here, Edwin said.
He wrenched back his sword. Drops of blood sprayed, splattered on Evrain's face and Edwin's uniform. Evrain's whole face fell. She became a tired old woman before his eyes. It was more than he could bear, so without another word, he sheathed his sword and launched himself down the path. Yet as he rounded a bend into the woods, and his thunder clapped much closer than it should have, steel thunked into Edwin's back, grated against his ribs, pierced his right lung. He recognized the feel of it. A Carowin throwing knife, the very one he'd thrown at Evrain only moments before. It hurt. Not to mention all the blood that bubbled up in his throat made breathing tricky. Yet Edwin couldn't help but smile, for Evrain was as ruthless as ever. At least that hadn't changed.
37. This might have been the dumbest plan Izzult had ever enacted, and by the Moon Mother, Merrick and his contract had better be worth it. 80 paces, Izzult thought as she watched the 17 sailors approach her at full speed down Legna's main seaside avenue. 12 more thumped down the first pier at which their ship was now anchored. Because, of course, Marstox had reached town right as Izzult and Safi had. Now soldiers, some of them no doubt fire witches, or worse, were pelting toward her with terrifying grace. Izzult didn't move, didn't flinch. She stood at the very edge of the city. When the sailors reached 20 paces away, she would move. That would be enough distance to stay ahead, or at least stay ahead long enough for Safi to get into town. Izzult had gotten a good glimpse of the terrain on the ride in, but most of her planning was based on guesswork. A lot of what she thought she knew about the cobblestone streets and byways of Legna could be wrong. And if those gaps in rooftops weren't streets, and that big square hole wasn't a central courtyard, then she was quite simply screwed. There were other holes in her plan, too. Like how the white kerchief cut from Safi's shirt, meant to hide Izzult's hair, might not stay put in all this wind. Or how her choice of an alleyway between row houses, with its shadowy darkness and steep incline, was a terrible one. Or how standing here with her arms high and cutlass still sheathed might be a bit too vulnerable. 60 paces. The sailor's eyes were now visible. The gleam of their outthrust sabers impossible to ignore, as were their threads of purple eagerness.
They won't kill you,
she reminded herself for the 100th time.
Stasis. Stasis in your fingers and in your toes.
Izzult sent Safi's threads behind her, burning with dark green readiness as she crept through the shadows of the forest. If Safi was ready, then Izzult would be ready too. Initiate, complete. Just in reverse this time.
30 paces.
Izzult braced her heels, sucked in a breath.
20 paces.
She ran. Shadows swallowed her whole, but gray light shone ahead, cobblestones and storefronts. Footsteps followed behind. Even in their soft boots and with lightning crashing closer every second, there was no missing the drum roll of Marstocky feet. Izzult skidded to the end of the alley, turning hard and aiming right.
Street, a wide one.
It was exactly what she'd hoped for. And it headed diagonally up the hill, toward some distant place that might be a courtyard. That had better be a courtyard. Broken doors and shattered windows coursed along the sides of her vision. The wind was still at her back, pushing her forward. Rain fell now, too. It splattered on the street, made the cobblestones slick. In the back of her mind, Izzult considered how to account for the rain when she reached the courtyard. It would affect her defenses. Or not, since there were definitely more men pouring out of the street ahead. The ones on the pier must have moved up the hill to cut her off. Izzult had run herself directly into a corner, and her plan was ruined before it had even begun. No, no. She could not let panic claim her. All she needed was a moment, just a brief second without Marstock's breathing down her neck. Izzult twisted sharply left. Her feet slipped. She tumbled forward and caught herself on a signpost. She lost precious time doing it, but no time to regret. Gulping in air, she punched her legs back into full speed. Surely this alleyway would lead her to another main road. Surely she could find a moment to think. Izzult honed in on individual cobblestones, on slamming one heel in front of the other and sucking down one more breath, then one more after that.
Stasis, stasis.
She could do this. She wheeled onto another wide lane, where there were more Marstocks, barreling from another alleyway ahead. One after another, they sprinted at her. She was trapped.
Or,
Izzult skidded left, right through a broken door. Her shoulder shrieked at the impact. She bit through her tongue, filling her mouth and her mind with the bark of pain and the taste of blood. It was exactly the distraction she needed. Calm briefly swept in and allowed her to scan her terrain. A shop with a counter and a doorway beyond. Izzult launched herself over the counter. The window exploded and the storm bawled through. Soldiers, too. But Izzult was already uncoiling and hammering out the back door into an alleyway. She skirted right, sharp and fast. Lightning flashed and wind gusted overhead, but the buildings protected her. Izzult hit a corner, swooped around, and poison darts skittered into the wall behind her. Which meant there were poison witches in the mix now. Marstocky adders. Suddenly, the buildings opened up. Light and wind sprayed down, and Izzult found herself in a courtyard. The courtyard she'd hoped for. A stained ancient fountain stood at the center. It was the Nubrevnan god Noden. All carved muscles and coiling hair, waiting on his coral throne. Izzult hopped onto the knee-high fountain rim, slick with wet algae and bird crap. It made spinning toward the Marstocks easier, but didn't offer much stability. All the while, the soldiers tumbled toward Izzult, a swarm of rain-soaked uniforms and focused threads. Small and lithe to enormously broad-chested, decidedly female to could be anything, really. With the wind and the rain thrashing down, and with black clouds churning overhead, Izzult's ears were useless. Her skin hammered to wet numbness. Then the first soldiers reached the courtyard and slowed. They eased to careful stops, and a female voice bellowed over the tempest's howl, "She isn't the one!" Izzult's gut cracked. Her left hand flew to her head. No kerchief. Her black hair was soaked through and fully visible.
"Find the real Domna," the woman ordered. "Back to shore!"
The ice in Izzult's stomach spread upward, choked off her air. They were going to leave? Just like that?
"Wait!"
she shrieked, springing off the fountain. If she could engage a few of them and keep them here, then maybe Safi could still make it. Izzult hurtled after the retreating soldiers, Several had paused and were swiveling back.
Slowly, so slowly.
Isolt reached for her cutlass, ready to attack.
Until
a crack of heat slashed through her. Then a coiling in of threads, so violent that Isolt's knees almost caved. In the space of a single breath, countless threads had simply snapped.
Broken. Cleaved.
The nearest soldier twisted all the way toward Isolt, his eyes black, his skin boiling.
Then he started shredding at his sleeves, at his skin,
while behind him, more and more soldiers were lurching back around toward Isolt.
And all of them were cleaving.
38. From behind a bleached alder, Sophie watched the ramshackle wharfside street. Her toes tapped, her fingernails dug into rough bark, and the urge to help Isolt was practically shredding her spine. But she stuck to the plan, and she waited until every single Marstock had followed Isolt down the alley. Then she scooted toward Lejna. She kept her eyes on the ship, rocking wildly at the first pier. Several sailors scurried about, but they were too busy with the growing thunderstorm to look Safi's way. Still, Safi unsheathed her Carowind sword just in case. Her eyes skipped between the approaching road and the nearest pier.
Empty. Empty.
All of them were empty of life. One of those docks had to be Pier 7 that Uncle Aaron had specified in his contract. Although at this point, Sophie wouldn't have been surprised to learn there was no Pier 7 at all, that Uncle Aaron had never had any intention of fulfilling his end of the deal. Well, the joke was on him, then. Because come hell flames or hagfishes, Sophie was getting Merrick that contract. A fat raindrop smacked Sophie's head right as she stepped onto the first cobblestones. She glanced at the sky, and then promptly started swearing. The storm was almost to Lejna, and it was definitely not a natural one. Not with all those black clouds.
What are you doing, Prince?
The rain picked up speed. A sudden wave crashed over the high water mark, submerging the first dock and swathing the cobblestones in slime. So much for stealth, then. Sophie kicked into a jog, then into a full sprint. At the storm's current rate, all three piers would be swallowed entirely in minutes. Sophie reached the first expanse of wood. It was coated in algae and creaked dangerously beneath her heels. She took four steps out, her eyes never leaving the tipping warship at the end, and then turned back, ready to barrel for the next pier. But the dock was slick, the waves too rough and the wind far too strong. Sophie was so focused on where to put her feet, on when to hop over the next surge of waves, that she didn't notice the dark figure slinking nearby. Not until Sophie was on the street again did she finally catch sight of the Marstocky Adder 30 paces away and right between her and the next pier.
"If you come with me,"
the Adder shouted, her voice and shape decidedly feminine,
"then no one gets hurt."
"No, thank you," Sophie thought, flinging up her sword. This woman was weaponless and Sophie was not. She flung up her sword.
"I'm giving you one chance, Truth Witch. You can either join the Marstocks as an ally, or you can die as our enemy."
Sophie almost laughed at that. A dark, angry laugh. For here was the moment she'd spent her whole life waiting for. The moment when her witchery put a target on her forehead and soldiers came to claim her. Admittedly, she'd expected hellbards all these years, but adders would more than suffice. Sophie sank into her stance, ready to attack. Lightning burst. She blinked. She couldn't help it. And by the time she got her eyes wide, wind was slashing into her, rain piercing her, and Of course, the woman was no longer weaponless. Where heartbeats before her hands had been empty, there was now a flail, its iron ball the size of Safi's skull.
"Where the rot did that come from?"
Safi muttered.
"And all those spikes on that ball?"
She skipped back, though the wind would hardly let her move, and briefly considered if Carowind steel was strong enough to slice through iron. She decided it wasn't, right as the spiky mass of death flew at her head. Safi ducked sideways. The flail zoomed past her forehead. A single barb slashed across her skin. Blood gushed into her eyes. And for the smallest fraction of a moment, the contract's words blazed behind her eyeballs. "All negotiations will terminate should the passenger spill any blood." Then the adder's boot was kicking at Safi's face, and she had no more space to think. Safi smacked the foot with her elbow, successfully tipping the adder's balance and also successfully bringing down the flail. Safi met the iron chain with her blade, yet where she thought the ball's momentum would carry the chain around her sword and allow her to yank the flail from the adder's grip, the iron seemed to melt apart, to slide over the steel, and to reform on the other side. Safi blinked blood and rain from her eyes, thinking surely she had misseen. But no. The woman was shifting chain link after chain link down to the iron ball, making the flail even bigger, the spikes even larger.
Oh, shit!
Safi was facing an iron witch.
Oh, shit, shit, shit!
She had severely misjudged her opponent. She couldn't fight this woman alone. Carowind steel was still iron, so her only chance would be to lose the sword, get past the adder, and then run like the void was at her heels. So that was exactly what Safi did. She flung her sword sideways, silently apologizing to Evrain, and when the adder snapped out her flail, aiming for Safi's thighs, she jumped as high as she could. Not high enough, though. The flail zoomed for her ankle, spikes and iron to crush her bone. Instinct took over. Midair, Safi twirled and punched out her right heel. It crunched into the adder's throat. She didn't get a chance to see what happened next. A charged wind exploded behind her, and the next thing she knew, she was flipping over the adder, carried by the cycloning storm. Then cobblestones were careening toward her face, much too fast, and Safi crashed down. Pain jarred through her. Rain fell now. Lightning crackled and hissed, carried on this raging wind. Safi scrambled up, blinking away water and teeth-shattering aches. Then she set off, stride determined for the second pier. As before, she took four steps onto the slick wood before racing back to the quay, to where the adder had caught up to her. So Safi did the only thing she could conjure. She tossed up her hands and shouted, "You can have me!" But the adder didn't lower her flail.
"Allow me to shackle you, Truth Witch, and I will believe you."
"Truth Witch," Safi called, shrugging innocently. "I think you have the wrong girl."
"False," her magic scraped.
"I'm only a domna, and not even from a good estate."
"You can't trick me," the woman roared.
Her uniform rippled in the wind. Her scarf was unwinding, a black flag that flipped and flew. For some reason, Safi couldn't stop staring at that black flap of fabric, and she couldn't push past her witchery.
"False, false, false,"
it shrieked over and over.
"Wrong, wrong, wrong."
It was far too great a reaction for a simple lie. Then Safi understood. Then she recognized. Cleaving. As soon as that word sifted through her consciousness, the sky exploded. A blast of heat and light erupted from the clouds, It blanketed all sight, swallowed all sound, masked all feeling. Safi's knees gave out. She toppled forward, blinking and reaching and straining for some sense of where she was, where the adder was, and above all, who was cleaving. A fuzzy image coalesced. The adder, on her knees, staring at her arms in horror. Arms that Safi noticed hazily had the sleeves ripped back. Was this woman cleaving? Safi pushed all her strength into sitting upright, into fighting the wind and the static so she could search the woman for signs of black or oil. Then she realized the adder's scarf was missing. It had unwound completely, and now the woman's black hair sprayed in all directions, framing a bronze, sharp, beautiful face. Safi was staring at the Empress of Marstock. The air witch storm had disrupted Edwin's magic, blocked Safiya's scent from his blood, or maybe she wore more salamander fibers. Either way, he'd had no choice but to push his power aside and simply follow the Marstocks by sight through Lejna, hoping they led him to Safiya. When he'd realized the sailors were converging in a courtyard, he ascended to the rooftops for a better view, and hopefully better speed. Yet by the time Edwin had reached the courtyard, he'd spotted the sailors sprinting back toward the sea, and the Nomatsi girl with no blood scent standing beside a statue of the Nubrevnin god. She had duped them all. A decoy. Edwin cursed, instantly flinging out his magic to search for the truth witch. He would deal with the Nomatsi girl later. But then Edwin caught the scent of something familiar. Black wounds and broken death. Pain and filth and endless hunger. Cleaving. Edwin's witchery fell into the background, briefly dulled by surprise, by revulsion as the Marstocks ripped at their uniforms, as black oil bubbled beneath their skin, as the Nomatsi girl squared off to fight them. Edwin knew he should leave. Now. Yet he didn't. He waited. He watched. Then he decided. A snarl broke through his lips. This was the puppeteer's doing. Edwin recognized her work by now. She must have figured out where the truth witch was, and now she tried to help Edwin in her own twisted, cleaving way. Which meant that if Isolde died here, Edwin would be to blame. The exact opposite of a life debt repaid. So Edwin ran to the roof's edge and jumped. He flew three stories toward the fountain. Air rushed into his ears, loud, fast. His right foot touched down. He pushed the power into a roll and tumbled to his feet, with barely enough time to keep from careening into the Thread Witch, who was swinging her cutlass at Edwin's head. He dove low and steel whistled through the air. "No!" was all he could shout before he unsheathed his sword and rounded on the nearest cleaved. The man was an adder, his black hood scratched off and his skin oily and writhing. He chomped at the air, searching for someone worth devouring. Edwin drove his blade through the adder's shoulder, then ripped it back out. Hot acid sprayed harmlessly onto Edwin's cloak. Yet a drop landed on his exposed face, searing into his cheek. So their blood really is poison. There was no time to dwell on that revelation. The cleaved man was already dragging himself onward, his acid blood eating through his uniform, revealing chest and arms fit to erupt from the roiling pustules. "The head!" the girl shouted before spinning her blade wide. Steel bit through flesh, through nerve and bone. The adder's head went flying, his body wobbling uncertainly, while acid spurted like a fountain into the courtyard. It splattered the girl's clothes, eating through the fabric. She stumbled back, then front-kicked the headless body. It collapsed. The girl gaped at her sleeves, as if shocked by the holes. Fool. Hadn't she seen the acid at work? It was her fault she'd stepped into it like that. Yet Edwin still found his mouth opening and the words, "Stay behind me," coming out. Then he angled toward four more Marstocks and set to work. They lurched at Edwin, and of course, the stupid Thread Witch did not stay behind him as ordered. Instead, she swooped out, blade arching at neck height. She missed. The nearest cleaved hopped back with unnatural speed. "Wind Witch," Edwin realized as he lanced out with his own blade. Again, the man leaped backward, skin brewing with black. Air blasted into Edwin. He staggered toward the fountain. The Thread Witch listed too, though she held her stance better. A deafening crack sounded behind Edwin. He had just enough time to twirl around, to see a rift splintering the fountain before the Thread Witch grabbed his cloak and yanked. The fountain exploded in a blur of ancient stone and water, but Edwin and the girl named Isolde were already soaring for the nearest alley. Clearly one of these Marstocks was a Tide Witch. And now that he had a source, Edwin would be no match. A magicked wind battered into Edwin's back, knife-like and meant to flay apart his skin. Yet Edwin's cloak protected him and he protected the girl. Edwin pumped his legs faster, pushed Isolde on. "Right!" he bellowed, and she skittered down the new passage. Rain fell hard now, biting. It only added to the cleaving Tide Witch's power. A bloodthirsty screech lifted over the streets. Several screams, tens of them even. "Left!" Edwin barked at the next shadowy intersection. He had no idea where he was going. Only that he needed a larger gap between him and the cleaved. He could hide the Nomatsi girl until this ended. Yes, Edwin would repay his life debt to Isolde, and then he would never think of her again. She wasn't the Kara Wen. She wasn't his problem. Edwin spotted a recessed doorway at the end of the road. The door was loose on its hinges.
"Ahead!" he shouted. "Inside!"
The Thread Witch's sprint faltered. She flung a look back, eyes wide.
"Do it!"
He grabbed her arm, grip vicious, and pumped his witchery through his blood. His speed doubled, the alleyway blurred, and the girl cried out. She wasn't running as fast, and he couldn't push her blood faster. But then they were to the doorway, and he was shoving her in. Yanking her toward the back of the house, pushing her through a kitchen, their gasps for air almost as loud as the howling wind and beating water outside.
"Pantry."
Edwin saw the tall cupboard at the back corner of the room, dangerously close to a shattered window, but the only hiding place he could spot. He shoved the girl toward it.
"Get inside."
"No."
She spun around to face him.
"What are you trying to do?"
"Repay a life debt. You spared me, now I spare you."
With a flick of his wrist, he unfastened his salamander cloak.
"Hide beneath this. They won't smell you."
He offered it to her.
"No."
"Are you deaf or just stupid? Those cleaved are seconds away. Trust me."
"No."
Her hazel eyes shook, but not with fear. With stubborn refusal.
"Trust me."
Edwin spoke more softly now, ears and magic straining for signs of the cleaved. They would be here at any moment, and this Nomatsi girl still wasn't budging. And if she didn't budge, then Edwin's life debt would remain unpaid. So he summoned the only words he could find that would make her go.
"Me Varujta,"
he said,
Mevarujta.
Her eyebrows shot high. How do you know those words?
The same way you do. Now get inside.
Edwin shoved her into the cupboard, hard. His patience was spent, and he smelled the approaching Cleaved. Blood-stained secrets and filth-encrusted lies.
The girl did as she was told. She stepped into the pantry, staring back at Edwin with that odd face of hers.
He tossed her the cloak. She caught it easily.
How long should I wait?
She asked. Then her gaze raked over his body.
You're bleeding.
Edwin glanced down at bloodstains from the old wounds and new patches from Evrain.
They're nothing, he muttered, before easing shut the door.
A shadow fell over the girl's face, but Edwin paused before he shut her out entirely.
My life debt is paid, Thread Witch. If our paths cross again, make no mistake. I will kill you.
No, you won't,
she whispered as the door clicked shut. Edwin forced himself to stay silent. She deserved no response. It would be her mistake if she thought he would spare her. So, lifting his nose and pushing his blood witchery high, Edwin whirled away and strode into a world of rain, wind, and death. Merrick flew in a blind terror. Cullen was almost to Legna, hurtling down to the first pier. But something was wrong. He had torn away from Merrick quicker than Merrick could fly, and with an uncontrolled violence that Merrick had never seen before. It had sent him spinning wildly behind, grappling for any sort of control he could find. When Merrick finally reached the city, he slammed onto the splintered first pier, to where he'd seen Cullen go down. But he saw nothing in the cycloning storm. Even more frightening, his magic pulsed against his insides, scratched wildly beneath his skin, as if people were cleaving nearby. As if they would soon send Merrick teetering over the edge. In leaping bounds, Merrick crossed the pier toward shore. Lightning cracked beside a storefront, and Merrick caught sight of Cullen. He knelt at the mouth of an alley, and fat, blinding veins of electricity ran the length of him. Then the lightning faded, and Cullen was hidden by air and seawater, kelp and sand. Merrick reached the street. He flew headfirst toward the spinning wall of lightning and wind. No. There was more now. Glass and splintered wood. Cullen was felling entire buildings. Merrick crashed against it all in a roar of light, sound, and static. Then it swept him in. The wind bent him, the water beat him, the magic engulfed him. And Merrick couldn't fight it. He wasn't half the witch Cullen was, and with his own powers feeling as if they might cleave at any second, Merrick could do nothing but let himself go. The cyclone funneled him upward, so fast he left his stomach somewhere far below. Up, up, up he flew. His eyes clenched shut. Debris pelted him. Glass peeled off his exposed skin. But then, as quickly as he'd been sucked into the storm, Merrick was released. The spinning stopped. The wind let go. Yet the storm raged on. Merrick heard it, felt it. Below. He forced his eyes open. Forced his witchery to keep him aloft just long enough to gauge what had happened. Merrick was in the clouds above Cullen's storm. Yet the cyclone was climbing, sucking in the clouds around Merrick and soon enough sucking at him, too. But there, hundreds of feet below, was a dark speck amidst the storm. Cullen. Without thought, Merrick threw himself forward in a painful thrust of his own wind. Then he released his hold on the magic and he fell. Faster than he had risen through this storm, he now plummeted back to the street. As he flew through a world of hell and witch storm, he never let his streaming eyes lose sight of his thread brother. Cullen saw him. Crouched on the cobblestones beside a torn apart, no, a still tearing apart building. Cullen clutched his chest with his head tipped back, and Merrick knew that Cullen saw him. Cullen's hands thrust up. A blast of wind knocked into Merrick, catching him as he fell, easing him onto the street, into the eye of Cullen's storm. As soon as Merrick's boots were on the ground, he lurched for his thread brother. Cullen was kneeling, face down now.
"Cullen!"
Merrick yelled, his throat ripping to produce any sounds over the storm's endless thunder, the crack of building frames and the shattering of windows. He dropped to the street. Glass shards bit into his knees.
"Cullen! Stop this storm! You have to relax and stop this storm!"
Cullen's only response was a shuddering in his back. A shudder Merrick knew too well, had seen too many times in his life. Merrick yanked his thread brother upright.
"Breathe!" he roared. "Breathe!"
Cullen angled his face toward Merrick, his lips moving ineffectually, his face gray and bubbling, and his eyes as black as Noden's watery hell. Breathing could not save Cullen. Not from this sort of attack. Merrick's thread brother was cleaving. For a single aching moment, Merrick stared at his best friend. He searched Cullen's face for some sign of the man he knew. Cullen's mouth opened wide, the cyclone screaming with his fury, and the corrupt magic charged through Merrick, threatening to cleave him too. But Merrick didn't cower back or push Cullen away. The storm outside was nothing compared to what raged within. Cullen's fingers, black blood oozing from burst pustules, latched onto Merrick's shirt.
"Kill me,"
he croaked. "No." It was the only thing Merrick could say. The only word that could possibly contain everything he felt. Cullen released him, and for the briefest flicker of a heartbeat, the black in Cullen's eyes shrank inward. He gave Merrick a sad, broken smile.
"Goodbye, my king. Goodbye, my friend."
Then, in a blur of speed and power, Cullen sprang upward and rocketed off the pier. Wind and wreckage crashed down on Merrick, slammed him against the street and blanketed all his senses. For an eternity, all that Merrick felt and all that Merrick was Cullen's cyclone. Until a great crack split the chaos and wood and pain thundered down. Merrick's world went black. 39. Isolde sat in the cupboard, her eyes squeezed shut and her senses extending outward, her witchery reaching for some sign of life, of the cleaved. As for the blood witch named Edwin, she was as blind to his threads as she had been. Only by looking at his face had she had any idea of what he'd felt, which was nothing at all as far as she could tell. And though Isolde had trusted Edwin not to kill her, and to probably not feed her to the cleaved, there had been no Verujta there. Me Verujta. It was the most sacred of Nomatsi phrases. A phrase that meant, "Trust me as if my soul were yours." It was what the Moon Mother had told the Nomatsi people when she guided them out of the war-filled Far East. It was what parents said to their children when they kissed them goodnight. It was what heartthreads said in their marriage vows. For Edwin to know such a phrase could only mean he'd lived with a Nomatsi tribe. or that he was no Mazi. Whatever the source of his knowledge, though, it didn't matter. He had helped Isolde. Now he was gone. Isolde's magic pricked up. She sensed a cleaved Marstock stalking by the broken window. Three wriggling strands of death moved with it, just like the ones she'd seen over the corpse in Vinyatsa City. Just like the ones she'd seen through the puppeteer's eyes. These threads were bigger, though, fatter and strangely long, stretching into wispy tendrils that vanished into the sky like a marionette on a stage. Isolde's breath punched out. Puppeteer. She was looking at the puppeteer's work right now. These severed threads stretched all the way to Poznan. Isolde was sure of it. Which meant the puppeteer had somehow cleaved all these men from afar. No, not somehow. She'd done it with Isolde's help.
All those plans and places tucked away in your brain, the puppeteer had said, have made the Raider King very happy. That's why he gave me this grand mission for tomorrow. So thank you. You made all of this possible.
The puppeteer had realized Isolde and Safi aimed for Lejna, and she had cleaved whomever she could grab hold of. Isolde was suddenly boiling beneath her cloak, suffocating inside this cupboard, burning inside her own head. She should have fought the puppeteer harder. She should have avoided sleep and stayed away from that woman's shadowy grasp. Isolde was going to retch. No, she was retching. Dry heaving and hacking because these cleaved were on her soul now. She had killed them by being weak.
A new set of threads flickered into Isolde's awareness. A bright living set that shoveled through Isolde's sickness. She knew these threads. That particular shade of determined green and worried beige.
Efrain!
The monk was right outside the window. In a heartbeat, Isolde was out of the cupboard. She couldn't let Efrain die, too. She leapt through the shattered window. Glass grabbed at her cloak, but its buckle held fast. Then she was pounding down the narrow street, aiming right, in the direction she sensed Efrain's threads. Rain cut her, burning the wound on her face. The storm was getting worse. The sky had come alive. It all roiled and tossed in a single direction, toward the wharf. Through the rain, Isolde glimpsed white. She pushed her legs faster, screaming,
Efrain!
The white paused, materialized into Efrain's shape and silver head. She glanced back, her face a mask of surprise, but her threads blue with relief. Black moved along a rooftop, streaked from a shadowy storefront. The cleaved.
Behind you!
Isolde shrieked, heaving out her cutlass. She was too late. The cleaved converged on Efrain, and the monk vanished beneath a horde of death. Isolde burned up the road as fast as she could, screaming and slashing the entire way. Her blades severed necks, sliced through legs. Pustules burst and acid hissed on the walls, on Isolde's cloak. Yet she swung and heaved and chopped, screaming Efrain's name all the while. Soon enough, there was no one left to kill. The cleaved were running. And where Efrain had fallen, there was nothing but a wide stain of red. Isolde spun, frantically searching doorways and shadows, but the monk was as gone as the cleaved. So Isolde squeezed her eyes against the storm and reached for threads. There, on the other side of the nearest alley, was a set of frightened white threads, swirling with gray pain. A lot of gray pain. Isolde pushed into the wind and hugged Edwin's cloak tight. He had told her the truth. The cleaved didn't seem to smell her. She reached an intersection of narrow row houses, Blood dragged along the ground, already splashing away with the rain. Isolt picked up her pace and followed Ivrain's trail as long as she could, but the downpour quickly washed away the blood. Even straining to sense the monk's threads, she soon lost sight of them, too. They moved so fast. Much faster than Isolt could travel in this storm. When Isolt shoved onto a familiar narrow street, she caught sight of the wave-beaten harbor several blocks ahead. She was on the western edge of town where she'd first come in. Sand and sea spray bore down on her, and the storm surged out. Wood cracked. Buildings crumbled. With an arm thrust up to protect her face, Isolt frantically searched for signs of Ivrain. A flash of white in the storm, or a flicker of the monk's threads. But Isolt saw nothing. The storm devoured everything. Isolt could barely sense the Cleaved anymore. In fact, they seemed to be fleeing the city and racing north. Lightning exploded. Isolt's eyes shuddered against the light, the heat. Magic crashed over her, shivered on her skin and in her lungs. She tumbled against the nearest wall and shrank within the cloak. For half of a seemingly endless breath, Isolt was crippled by her guilt, by how much she hated herself and her magic and the puppeteer. But then the storm withdrew. The noise and the pressure and the mauling rain pulled back, and threads scissored into Isolt's awareness. Living threads nearby. She lurched upright, tossing back the cloak to find the cyclone leaving. It spiraled over the sea like a writhing black snake. Isolt limped into a demolished alley, searching for the living threads. Her feet crunched through glass until, at last, she found the Prince of Nubrevna. Bruised, bleeding, and trapped beneath a fallen building. Yet he was still alive, and Isolt was still alive to save him. A laugh writhed in Safi's throat as she stared blearily at Vanis. Of course it would be the Empress of Marstock. Who else would have the balls to fight with a flail? Or be insane enough to come after Safi herself? Rain fell, wind charged, strong as an ox and growing stronger, and waves threatened to cover the entire street. A hurricane roared at the other end of the city, but Safi never looked away from Empress Vanis. If the woman cleaved. But gods below, could she kill an empress? Safi's eyes flicked to the flail, an arm's length from Vanis and all but forgotten. If the Empress was cleaving, that weapon was Safi's only option. Vanis stilled. She stopped scratching her arms, stopped moving at all. Her gaze was pinned behind Safi. 12 protect me, she said. If she's speaking, then she isn't cleaving, Safi thought. Whatever corrupt magic had surged through Vanis, the Empress hadn't succumbed. But then Safi made the mistake of following Vanis's gaze. The storm was leaving, a single figure at its center. Lightning sizzled down its black form as it curved and twisted and charged out to sea. Colin! Oh, gods! Safi swayed, but forced her head to stay up so she could search the street. She saw no sign of Merrick. Surely he had not been killed. Yet before Safi could propel herself that way, Vanis shouted, "Give up, Truth Witch!" Shit! Ever so slowly, Safi turned back to Vanis, who stood with her flail ready. Safi wet her lips. They tasted like blood and salt. Maybe if she could distract Vanis, she could bolt away.
"Why you?" she asked. "Why not send your soldiers to kill me? Why risk yourself?"
"Because I am a servant to my people."
If I must dirty someone's hands, then I will always dirty my own.